Hi, and welcome to the They Call Me the Ghost podcast, a podcast for those looking for good stories, looking for adventure. Today's episode is Haunted State Hospital, going insane in the insane asylum. One man gets lost in a historical state hospital when a development project turns into a nightmare. Narrated by me, the ghost, each and every time. Let's get started. Hello, it's the ghost. Welcome to your weekly dose of the real world, where truth is stranger than fiction and things are not always as they seem. Today's episode has to do with history, in more ways than one. A place that, because of how it is, where it was, and what it was for, made its mark, starting in the 1800s. The place has been around for centuries, but shut down for years. So when an architect walked into the place, he had eyes only for the possibilities. He had no idea he was walking into what's possible. They call me the ghost. I was an agent for the CIA, but today I'm an independent operative, working on the side of the mysterious and unbelievable. And today is the story of how we should never lose sight of those that come before us, or the true meaning of respect. Take a listen and enjoy. I chose to tell this story here this fall because it was fall when we worked this case. And it's a Saturday night when the request comes in, and we're all at the warehouse. We're actually starting our end of year prep. We kind of start to go through things, cases we've worked that year, things we want to file away. You know, we're going through everything. And I had just turned down two requests the day before, that Friday. And while we're there that Saturday night, another request comes in. And unlike the ones that I got on Friday, this one sounds interesting right from the beginning. It starts out like they usually do. The requester tells me who he is, a little bit about himself, you know, his name, and I'm going to refer to him as Derek Anderson. He's an architect, and from the list he provides of all of his work, he appears to be a very good one. He explains that he's taken advantage of an opportunity to work on a dream project, the type of project that he'd been waiting for. Says that it's the only project he's working at the moment because he wanted to dedicate all of his time to it. It was a redevelopment project. And he was actually staying and working on the premises. All business there had been shut down, and he had run of the place to dream, imagine, and create a proposal that would be accepted. This is what was supposed to be happening anyway. But he says that there's something very wrong, and he is losing focus. He does realize that there's a real possibility that he's simply losing his mind, but he doesn't think that's it. He feels that there's something there with him, something that should not be. Derek shares that his project is being worked behind the scenes, and he can't go to anyone local. He doesn't want to call on any type of authority, so he's been led to me. And he tells me that to write it all down in the request, you know, everything that's going on would make him sound even more crazy than he already feels. So he asks if I would meet with him on site so that he can better show me and explain what this is all about. It's absolutely possible to me that there could be something odd going on where he is, and I agree to meet Derek. The following day, I'm on my way to where he is, which is a small town in the northern Midwest, and to a former state hospital there, and a big one. When you drive up to this place and the closer you get, you really realize what a sprawling structure it all is. The front of the building stands tall with a castle-like design. And the closer you get, though, you soon realize there's much more to the place than that front welcoming building standing before you. You soon can't help but notice how it expands off to the sides and even beyond from there. I'd seen pictures, but I'd never been there. And it was as if I was shrinking the closer to the place I got. And so you can understand and picture more about where I am, let me explain it a little bit more. This hospital is a state hospital. And as I said, it opened long before any of us were around, in the late 1800s. This is not a typical psychiatric facility that you might picture in today's world. I mean, it's not even close. Originally named an asylum, this state hospital was old and it was huge. And it was said to be empty, except for Derek. The structure is around 500,000 square feet. There are grounds. I mean, the whole thing, it was a campus. They grew their own food. They were completely self-sufficient. They had their own morgue. They had their own graveyard. They had it all. Thousands went through the place. They'd go in and spend the rest of their lives there, deemed crazy and kept away from the rest of society. And now this place was on the verge of being demolished, unless Derek could save the day with something amazing. To see the place in person, it was a bit overwhelming to think that someone was actually staying there all by themselves, but he was. And something was happening, something big enough for him to get a hold of me. And somehow, I believed that was possible. I pull up out front, and I'm not even out of my seatbelt yet before I see Derek open the door to greet me. He doesn't come out to the car, though, which I found strange. I look at him and wave, and he just stands there, waving back, so I get my bag, and I get out and go meet him. Derek's got brown hair, and unlike his pictures, it's a little longer, revealing more of his curl. He's wearing a brown sweater, khakis, some nicer type tennis shoes, you know, basic stuff. My first impression, seeing him in person, was that he looked very relaxed, which was very different than the pictures I saw of him, you know, more posed with his work. The guy had a big smile. He looked friendly. I go up to him and we introduce ourselves and we head on in. And just walking through the front door of this place, I am eager to see the rest of it. I was surprised though when Derek asks that we skip any tour for now, because he wants me to understand how he sees things first so that I can keep that in mind when he does take me around. He tells me he's fully aware that I may not even believe anything that he says. He just wants the best shot he can get. So we go straight back to where he's staying. He's moved into a couple of connected rooms in the back offices, and that's where he'll be staying and working while he's there. Derek explains how his city guy made sure that he was set up with all that he needed, so it's actually not bad. And we get in there, and Derek hesitates a little bit before explaining anything. He's standing there looking out the window as if he's looking for someone. And then he says that he's around. Now, I don't ask any questions yet, and I wait for him to elaborate when he's ready. But to keep things moving, after a while, I do get him away from the window by asking him about the pictures on his desk. He has two sort of scenic ones and one of a dog. He picks them up one at a time and explains them to me. The first one is of the old bridge. It's the oldest bridge in Florence, Italy, actually, which I have seen before. And he tells me that it was there that his passion for architecture came to life within him. His father took him on that trip that summer during high school, and it was on that trip that started him on a journey down the path his father took. He would follow in his footsteps in designing buildings and spaces, creating works of art for the people to know and be in and enjoy. The next one Derek picks up is a picture of the Guggenheim, the museum in Spain. If you haven't been there, go there. That's all I can say. But Derek tells me that he has that picture with him because that is his idea of grand. And it always reminds him what that is. Derek stops and explains to me that he keeps both of those pictures with him for inspiration, how his love of architecture began, traveling with his father. And then as far as the Guggenheim goes, it shows him that when something can be created that is that beautiful and impactful, that's when it's all worth it. And that's what drew him to this job that he's on now, the one he's hoping to get. I mean, he could only hope and wish to design something like the Guggenheim, but this project at the hospital could also be something grand if he was given the chance. He then picks up the last picture, and it is of a golden retriever. Derek looks at me and smiles and says that that is his dog, and sure enough, he walks over to the other side of the room and pushes open the door that's ajar there, and inside, on a giant dog pillow, is this fluffy, tannish gold golden retriever. Derek sets his picture down and calls the dog over by name, Burnham. He says he sometimes calls him Bernie for short, and that he's named after the architect Daniel Burnham, the man known for building the first skyscraper. So within the first 10 minutes, it's obvious to me that Derek is very passionate about his work and his dog. We go back over to his sitting area, and he starts to tell me the story about what's going on. The city had already gone through well over a dozen designers, architects, and developers over the years. And with Derek sliding in just as their doors were closing, they decide to give him a chance. It would be the last chance to save this great building. And they weren't going to publicize that he was even there, though, because the town had been through enough, they said, and it would only cause more disruption. The people there were very divided on if the place should be saved or not. So Derek agreed to keep quiet. He would stay on location, away from anyone else, research the grounds, finalize his designs and plans, and all was good. They didn't anticipate any issues. In fact, his contact wasn't even in town. He was off on vacation somewhere, and Derek was left to do his thing. His plan would be to stay there for a month, and he'd been there 9 days so far. Well, his very first night there, it rained. It was a storm, actually. And he was just in his little space reading and about to fall asleep when he thought he saw something outside of his room. It got his attention enough that he gets up and goes out into the hall to look around. But he doesn't find anyone or anything. With his dog by his side, he starts to wander a bit and gets caught up in how it all looks at night. Tells me how he was content, traveling in his mind as the storm's rain hit the ground and bursts of light lit up the hallways. He imagined what it would have been like way back then, the rooms filled with patients and the doctors walking the halls. He was in a zone. But while walking around, Derek says he also got a feeling about the place. A feeling like the place was more than just brick and sandstone. It felt almost alive with an eerie energy. I mean, he couldn't exactly say that eerie was the right word. He admitted, I mean, how else could you feel walking around this place in the middle of the night alone in the middle of a storm? But he did notice he felt like that nonetheless. He felt uneasy. When he decides to go back to his room that night after looking around, he calls out to Burnham, but he doesn't hear his dog feet running after him. So Derek stops, turns around, doesn't see his dog. He backtracks a bit until he finds him. He's inside one of the rooms off to the side, and he's just sitting there. He's sitting there facing sideways and into the room, and he's growling, this very low growl. So Derek calls out to him, but again, the dog doesn't move. So Derek goes in closer to see what has his attention, and he almost jumps back when he sees that there's a man standing there. Well, Derek does the expected, you know, hello and who are you, as he pets Burnham to calm him down. And the guy tells him he's the groundsman, one of many that had worked there over the years, says he's been there forever and still keeps an eye on the place. He looked friendly enough, and Derek figured it was probably just a miscommunication, that he was told no one would be there. I mean, there probably is someone there keeping an eye on the place. It makes sense, so he doesn't overthink it. The groundsman introduces himself as Joe. Joe the groundsman. And then he asks Derek what he's doing there. And for some reason, Derek says he felt almost hesitant to tell him. But the guy's just a groundsman, so he thinks, well, he's not the whole town, so he figures there's no harm. And he tells him. But Joe doesn't really say anything about it. Instead, he talks about the hospital, talks about the many patients that had gone through there and the brilliance of the physician who designed it and stuff like that. And then he asks Derek if he's seen the graveyard. Well, of course, Derek had heard of it, and he'd seen it from afar. He'd gotten the big tour of the place, and they went by the graveyard. He didn't go up to it and inspect it or anything, but he told Joe that, yes, he'd seen it. And then Joe asked him what his plans were for that. And Derek tells me it was right then that he got an even heavier feeling of uneasiness. He told Joe that he hadn't gotten that far, but to be sure, his plan was to keep the integrity of the place. Well, Joe didn't seem to love or hate that answer, and apparently he had to be somewhere all of a sudden, and he just left. Well, Derek peeks out into the hall after him. Doesn't see him in the darkness, but he did hear his footsteps as he walked away. And Derek admits the whole thing shook him up. You know, getting interrogated by some creepy groundsman in the middle of the night was not something he expected. But he tried to move on from it and just stay focused on his project. After that first night, it became Derek's routine to walk around before he went to bed. Said it would help calm him and keep him in the groove of the sense of the place. And during those walks, though, he's run into Joe more times. Joe's popped out of rooms, walked up to him from behind. Derek tells me that Joe is odd, and that after each of those little run-ins, he ends up feeling a little confused and off. It's like seeing him does something to him. And it does something to his dog, too. Whenever he sees the groundsman, Bernie starts barking and seems to go a little crazy himself. Derek doesn't know what's up with the guy, but he does know that neither he or his dog feels very comfortable around him. And what Derek doesn't like and what he finds unsettling also is that he'll barely remember what happens after their chats. One night, he doesn't even remember going to sleep at all, and then just woke up the next day at like 2 in the afternoon. Seems like whenever he sees Joe, he has some sort of memory loss or lost time. And he's asked Joe where he's even staying on the grounds, but Joe never says. He always diverts to some other subject. Overall, things weren't going very well around Joe. But that wasn't all. Derek says he started hallucinating, and with every Joe run-in, it seems to get more intense. He's seen bloody sheets on beds, water running and overflowing in therapy tubs. He's heard people both laughing and crying. He's even started seeing things in the daytime. Never the groundsman, though. He only sees him at night. And then on top of that, Derek breaks out a folder that he says he didn't even know existed until the day before I got there. And it's his own work. It's full of drawings and notes, all dated, and in his handwriting. And if it really is his work, according to the notes, he's been at it for the last 5 days. He is, or at least he thinks he is, pretty much aware of what's going on in the daytime, so is he working all this up in the middle of the night? He has no memory of working on any of it, so he has no idea. The papers he found are not drawings and ideas for the hotel he wanted to create. You know, they're not for his project. They were pictures that he drew out, notes about what went on in places like this. And his drawings seem to be focused on all of the tunnels and the electric shock therapy room. And some of the drawings are not pretty. After he explains everything to me, he's starting to look pretty exhausted. I mean, this man, Derek, who gave the impression of being relaxed when I got there, was a complete mess underneath all of that. Who is this groundsman, and what does he know? We need his story. And what is going on with this place to cause Derek to lose his mind like he is? There's so much history here, it could be anything. Well, I go on to have a video call with my team, and it's decided that Scarlett, Ryder, and Frankie will join me at the hospital. And while I wait for them to get there, I'd like to see more of the place, and Derek needs to get out, so he takes me on a small tour. And in the meantime, while we're out doing that, I've asked Harley to check out who this groundsman might be. And I want a full list of anyone who's ever worked the grounds on this property. There's definitely an energy about this place, and why wouldn't there be? So much has happened there. And I'm not limiting myself to only those that would still be alive and working today. We have to be open to anything. All right, well, Derek shows me where the tubs are that he watched overflow right before his eyes, but there isn't even any water running to those rooms now. He takes me over to the building where that shock therapy treatment used to be carried out. And Bernie's with us, but the closer we get to that place, the more the dog's having a fit. The doors to this smaller building are locked, but we can see through the windows, and the place does not look like any fun. I know they still do some forms of shock therapy today, and that doesn't even sound appealing, but no one would ever want to go into this building, I can tell you that. It looked more like a torture chamber. With the dog going crazy, we don't stay long there, and next up, Derek takes me up to the roof, where we can step outside and get a good view of the layout of the entire place. This campus takes up a lot of space. 500 acres or so is, or was, dedicated to their livestock and their horses. We can see where their gardens were. We can see the graveyard. Records show that there are over 3,000 people buried there. We see a lot that day, but we don't see any groundsmen. By 7 p.m., my team arrives, and we spend some time getting to know each other. Derek helps fill in some of the blanks for the team, and at about 10 p.m., we head out, joining Derek on the walk that he does every night. He lets us know that it's not even something he feels like doing anymore or wants to do. It's something he feels like he just has to do at this point. And it's quiet when we start out, and the only sound we really hear are the dog's toenails hitting the floor as he walks with us. We had flashlights, but we don't even need them. The windows in this place are giant, and the moon is full. This place originally was built to give patients, you know, access to sunlight and fresh air. On one side, this hospital took a homeopathic approach with regards to caring for the mentally ill, while also still practicing some of the immoral treatments they did back then. At the same time that this facility opened its doors, the psychiatric world was working towards getting away from things that harm patients. But they weren't quite there with all things. Well, we're going along, and everything's fine, until all of a sudden, Derek starts chasing after something. We don't see anything, but he's walking fast along the windows, and he's tapping on them like he's trying to get someone's attention. He tells us that Joe is outside, the groundsman. Well, we head over there, but we don't see anything. I mean, Derek is tapping and waving and pointing, telling us he's right there, until eventually he tells us that Joe's left, and then he falls limp to the floor. We get him back to his room, and he's shivering, but he's sweating. We get him into a blanket, and he starts laughing. It's this crazy laugh, and he's rocking back and forth. It's clear the man is somewhere else. And as that's happening, Scarlett lets out a small grunt, and now she's hunched over, complaining of stomach pains. Feels like she's going to throw up, she says. She tells us she's been flooded with this very sick feeling that came out of nowhere. She slowly starts to come out of it, but she isn't feeling great. Frankie and Ryder head out to where Derek saw the groomsmen, and they set up a thermal imaging camera. If Joe comes back, hopefully we can catch him. It's looking more and more like we are dealing with the paranormal here. This groundsman, he's either here or he's not. I mean, no one was supposed to be here but Derek, and now this man that wasn't there. Well, Frankie and Ryder go on to set up more equipment in some of the other places we passed along the way. There should be zero movement in these areas, unless we're there. And my team and I, we're all hooked up to the cameras through our digital wrist computers, so any changes in activity, and we'll be notified. In learning a little bit about the place before any of us left, we read a lot about the hauntings that were said to have happened there over the years. So this to us was a very real possibility. People had seen shadows outside and inside. Sounds, screams, cries were heard. Lights went on and off. There were a lot of unexplained events. Now, before Frankie and Ryder return, we hear a bang coming from outside the room somewhere. I immediately head out to try to figure out where it's coming from. And normally I wouldn't go alone, but with Scarlett feeling the way she is, I do because it has to be checked out right then and there while it's happening. There haven't been any notifications from our cameras, so I know where not to go. I hear more of the banging, and I just head towards it, and eventually I do find the source. It's a door that is opening and closing and banging as it shuts. I catch one more slam as I come upon it, but then once I'm there, it all stops. I go up to the door, and I open it. It's dark on the other side, and all that I can see is a small set of stairs. I break out my flashlight, and I head on in. There is a switch there, and I flip that on, but it doesn't do much. The stairway is lined with these very small yellow bulbs. I get down to the landing. I don't find anything, so I keep going. When I get to the bottom, I find a long hallway, a tunnel with pipes along the ceiling. I walk down it for a ways. I don't get too far. I mean, trying to see if someone's there, causing the banging. But again, I find nothing. While I'm down there, I get a notice from Harley. She has sent me a list of all the known groundsmen that worked there over the years. Finding nothing where I am, I decide to head back to reconvene with the crew. I get there, and Scarlett informs me that Derek has not stopped talking. He's just babbling away, talking a bit about the facts of the place, a bit of nonsense, and seems to be focused on the year 1920. Well, Frankie and Ryder are back now, and I explain where the banging was coming from, the door that leads to the underground tunnel. And what we know from our research there is that all the buildings here are connected by those underground tunnels. Each building has a separate access to them. Anything mechanical happened down there. Wiring, heat, steam, gas, electric, water, sewer, you name it. It was all fed from the basement. There were also areas for autopsies down there where some of the medical staff did certain things, and there was a morgue down there. There were stories that we read of the lights going out and shutting down, and if that happened, it was a pitch black that people had never seen before. Very creepy. It was no wonder that employees would get freaked out by the place, and sometimes it just got to be too much. Which brings us to that employee list of groundsmen anyway. With Derek still in his own little world, we, the team and I, go over what Harley sent over. And you'd think that that list would be really long, but for the most part, it appeared that people either couldn't handle things and they left in a hurry, or they stayed a while, so the list was manageable. And with Derek sticking with the year 1920 and saying that over and over again, we decide to start there. There were 7 groundsmen during that year, and we find the head of that group to be a Mr. Joseph Lee. A coincidence? Well, like always, are there really any coincidences? Looks like this guy joined the crew in 1897, but then for some reason drops off the list. And yep, you guessed it, the year 1920. We don't find any formal record of his departure, however. There's no release from employment or termination of employment. He just drops off the list. And employees sometimes did just leave without formally giving any notice or anything. And it was meant to be a place of healing, but that doesn't mean this hospital was an easy place to work at. There were many stressors, and it was not uncommon for an employee to choose to be gone, leave their job and the premises without notice. Sometimes the patients and the grounds, all of it, just got to be too much. Writer speaks up at that point, saying that there must be something more here. If this truly is Mr. Joseph Lee or the spirit thereof, then something went wrong. This would be an unsettled spirit that needs to be put to rest, and that means that we need to find the cause of his distress. Well, I respond to Harley, and I ask her to send over any information that she can on this particular man. And we need to do something, so we decide that we're going to start with Derek's drawings, which seem to be focused on the electric shock therapy building and those creepy underground tunnels. So that's where we're going to start. Frankie, Ryder, and I head out, while Scarlett again stays with Derek. She still isn't feeling so hot, so staying back is a good place for her right now. If we're dealing with some sort of spirit here, you know, it's not like we can just go out and capture it. We need to find the source of the issues that are happening. And we are going to start with the shock therapy building. It feels like a long walk out to that building in the dark, but we do have the moonlight, which is helpful. We see the building in the distance, and then I catch a glimpse of light coming from inside, and then we all see it. There are glitches of light flashing on and off. We start to hear screams as well, so we pick up the pace, but when we get there, all is quiet. The doors are locked just like they were earlier, and when we shine our flashlights in, it's just like it was earlier, just as you would expect. It's old and dusty and full of webs. There is nothing going on there. So what did we see? Well, Ryder says she can sense that something's there. I don't know if you remember, but she has an extensive history with the paranormal, so we take what she says very seriously. Right after she says that, though, she gets this look of horror on her face. As she stands there shining her flashlight in through the window, she doesn't say anything, but her mouth opens up and a tear runs down her cheek, and she looks like she is in shock. Frank and I both look, try to see what she sees, but we don't see anything. It's just the same old dust and webs. We pull her back from the window and start to walk back to the main building. And even though the walk is long, when we get back there, Ryder is still not okay. She tells us she's been overcome by a feeling of heavy sadness. She tells us that what this all stems from is from something awful that happened, and that there is much pain around it. Whatever got a hold of her has drained her of all her energy. I mean, she's barely walking by the time we get back to Derek's room, even though she's feeling a little bit better. But she just joins Scarlett sitting on the edge of the bed, and Frankie and I, we're now the only ones left unaffected at this point, and finding nothing in the shock therapy building, we decide it's time to head down into those tunnels. So we go back to the door that I was at earlier, that was opening and closing and banging, and we slip on our headlamps, and we make sure our wrist computers are hooked up and running, and we head on down. We take our time, and we go quietly. And that was actually a good thing, because once we're down there, we notice this large ball of bats. They're all stuck together in the corner of the ceiling, right at the bottom of the stairs. It would definitely not be awesome to disturb those guys while we're down there. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to take cover. So as silently as we can, we move forward. We do pick up the pace a tad once we feel we're at a safe distance from those guys. The only sound we hear are these small drops of water every now and again. After we walk a while, though, we do hear some type of moaning sound. It's a man. It sounds like he's in pain. Could this be our man? We eventually get to this larger area that actually opens up to a few rooms. And it's easy to see that this is where all the autopsies took place. And then we find the area where the morgue was as well. Once inside, the moaning stops. We're thinking, you know, does this mean that we're close? Or have we just gone in the completely wrong direction? We can't know for sure. The rooms are empty, but there are a few things that are left behind, enough that you could picture what went on in this place. It's not every day you find yourself in a morgue. It's not exactly pleasant. The autopsy room was no fun either. This is where the doctors worked at trying to figure out what caused the deaths of their most disturbed citizens. Back then, they still had the hopes of finding answers to things that we still today know very little about. This whole area that we're in is set off to the side of the main tunnels. There are more doors and stairways up to the main level from this place, but we stick to checking out what's down there. We notice that beyond these areas is a storage room of sorts. It goes back pretty far, and there's still a lot in there. Forgotten items from the past, things left behind. It would be junk to anyone finding it today, but for us, we're seeking information and looking for anything that we can get that would give us a clue. So we start rummaging through a few things. We don't find a whole lot. We do find one area, though, that's full of these crates, and that catches our eye. So we start to go through those, but again, we don't find anything interesting until we get to the one. After wiping away some of the dust, we see a nameplate, and it says Lee. So we open it up, and we find quite a few items. Like some of the other crates we took a look at, these appear to be items from those that have passed. I guess, what would you do with all the items of those forgotten people? It would be pretty morbid to just throw everything away, so they must have decided to just keep everything. What's interesting to us, though, with this crate is that it has a couple of dresses inside of it, a small jewelry box, and a pair of women's shoes. So we found a name, but why are there women's clothes in here if the guy that Derek is seeing is named Joe? Thoughts are firing off in all kinds of different directions, but this doesn't really make any sense. Our groundsman is a man. We know this for sure, so what is all of this stuff? Well, Frankie starts digging around in the same area to see if there's anything else with the name Lee on it. He doesn't find another crate with the name, but he does find something very disturbing. He finds some bones. We both go in a little closer and check it out, and we see that what he found was a foot. And we follow it through the rubbish and find out there's a body down there. Looks like the body of a man. Being down in this place and out of the elements, some of his clothes are still intact. Well, at least enough to see what they are. This looks like a man who's wearing heavy trousers and a shirt. His shoes have fallen off and are turning to dust beside his bones. We also can't help but notice that whoever this man was injured. His leg was broken. Could he have fallen while down in this place? We're not sure, but this could definitely be something. And then, next to the body, we see there's different old papers and things, and we find one folded up by this guy's side. So we open it up to see what it was, and it looked to be a letter. And we can't help but notice that it's signed by Joe at the bottom. And I can still remember what that letter was about. You know, it said that theirs was an interesting story from how they met until the end, and that their chance meeting was a surprise, and their fate was a surprise as well. He talked about how no one could have guessed that a love so strong could be interrupted in such a harsh way. Interrupted, but not broken. He wrote about how, although he lost the woman he fell in love with years ago, his love never died, and how he would never take back the last 20 years, being by her side until her end. He wrote about how strong his love was for her, and that without her, he was nothing. So it seemed fitting that even as he sat there now, knowing his own end was near, all he could think about was her. I remember he went on to profess more of his love to her. It was actually quite heartbreaking. The whole thing was looking more and more like a tragedy for two people that probably never meant any harm. We don't have the full story on any of this, however, and we don't know what this other Lee's role in the hospital was. We go back upstairs, and I immediately get Harley on the phone. We don't have our complete computer set up at the hospital, obviously, so I need her to do some more digging for me. And what she finds out helps us start to put together a picture. There was a Mr. Lee, a Joseph Lee, that was the head groundsman during the year 1920. He was one of the employees, though, that went missing that same year. Assumed to have had enough, like it happened with so many others, there was no fuss made about it. The interesting part here that helps put this all together, though, is what else Harley found. There was also a Shannon Lee, who was also a Mrs. Joseph Lee. Although Joseph was a groundsman, it would appear that Shannon was a patient. And that was a surprise. She was admitted when she was 35, in the year 1897. Joseph became an employee that same year, at 37 years old. Well, Mrs. Lee died while in shock therapy at the age of 58 in 1920, and 3 months after that, Joseph went missing at the age of 60. Well, no wonder management, you know, would have thought that Joseph just left. Probably assumed he was both sick of the place and grieving. He would have no reason to stay now that his wife had passed. The whole reason he got a job there was because his wife was committed. My next question, though, was, did he actually make it out? Well, Harley can't find any record of Mr. Joseph Lee anywhere out in society. His paycheck stopped, and that was the end of it. There was nothing else on the man. Harley does tell us, though, that she has confirmed that Shannon is one of the 3,000-plus that is buried on the premises, in the graveyard. She also tells us that there were two gravestones purchased for the Lee family, one for a Mr. Joseph Lee and the Mrs. Shannon Lee. However, Mr. Lee is not on record for ever being buried there. And while we're going over all of this, our wrist computers start going crazy. Our cameras are catching activity, and apparently a lot of it. So we stop what we're doing and we spread out and we hit all of them. But by the time we get to each of them, the activity has died down to nothing. This is a sign to us, though. We're onto something. Well, we do actually end up getting some sleep that night, a few hours anyway. And the next morning, with Derek, Scarlett, and Ryder all feeling a little bit better, we all head out to the graveyard. And it takes us a while, but we do find Shannon Lee's gravestone. And right next to that, we find a gravestone for Mr. Joseph Lee. And Burnham is there with us, and he's sniffing around like crazy. He's wagging his tail, and he seems to be in better spirits instead of all the growling and fussing around he was doing before. So we're thinking and hoping that that's another sign that we are on the right track. And again, this all adds to the story. And what really tops it off is when Harley sends over a picture of Mr. Lee. And when Derek sees it, he falls to the ground in shock. That is the man that he has been seeing and talking to. He tells us that that man is the groundsman. But we now know that that man has been gone for about 100 years. We also know now that that man is dressed the same as our skeleton down in the tunnels. Now, Ryder has a lot to say about this, again, with her paranormal experience. With what Derek was trying to do, he was probably seen as a possible threat to the people buried there. This was disturbing for Mr. Lee, who apparently is an unrested prisoner of the place. The likely story here is that Mr. Lee went down to be close to his late wife's things. Somehow he must have fallen and gotten hurt, but nobody ever found him. He was left and forgotten. A man more in love than most, who was then assumed to have been just a man who walked away from his responsibilities, a man broken by what had happened around him. But that was not the truth at all. And so here he was, trying to get that truth out. A very sad and disturbing circumstance. And it's not like spirits that are on the other side or even halfway there can communicate with us like we communicate with each other. It's very awkward and the meaning gets lost in translation. It would appear that Mr. Lee was trying to fill Derek with the truth and show him things that had happened. There was only so much he could say. He couldn't stick around and hold a conversation for very long, although he tried. And his visions and heavy presence only caused Derek to get sick. Because we're dealing with such a big place, and this is very serious stuff, I needed to call in some specialized backup here. We're not about to remove skeletal remains. We're not about to bury someone in this cemetery. It was time to get Derek's contacts involved and the right people to take care of business. At the end of the day, Derek changed his mind about working on the hospital. He said there was too much history there, and for him, it all just got to him too much. He couldn't continue in that location. Although happy that we were able to solve one of many mysteries in and around that place, Derek's memories of it now were dark and disturbing, and he just wanted and needed to move on. Eventually closing out with the city officials and explaining to them all that went on there, it was now in their hands. It seemed pretty impossible that our Mr. Joseph Lee would be the only disturbed spirit there. And the city and their people, they were set to bring in special paranormal teams, and then they would decide on the fate of this place and what they would do next. That part was not our concern. And that was our job, working in a place with a massive history behind it. And here we are in the present day with people trying to make future plans around it and decisions about something that may not yet be settled. What all went on there, no one can know for sure, but it seemed very apparent to us that there were things still going on today. Things that were unexplainable, disturbing. And we hear of people around the world digging up graves or building on burial grounds. There's always something uneasy about stuff like that. And can we really say that although we live today, that that is the most important thing, the only thing to be concerned about? We think we know best because we are here. We are conscious, living, and being. But unless you have lived, died, and come back from the dead, how do any of us really know what happens beyond the grave? What energy remains? What unfinished business is there? In our experience, there is not one of us on the team that would ever not consider what has happened before our time and what impact it could have on us in the here and now. Something to think about. Thank you for listening to the story on this job. I appreciate you taking the time to be here with me this Friday and this weekend. Like, subscribe, turn on your notifications if that's your thing. And until next time, know that I always have more stories to share. And I will talk to you all soon.